One-on-One. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'm in the newsroom of AlaskaDispatch.com, a news organization which has become one of the biggest, if not the biggest, and with some of the most experienced staff in Alaska, and with the publisher and owner of the website, Alice Rogoff, who is my guest today. Thanks for so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And we like to refer to this as the world headquarters.
The world headquarters, yeah. In an airplane hangar, which where you keep your 206.
Absolutely.
How did that, just the convenient space to stick everybody into?
Actually, that is part of the thinking, but what got us started was that we were going to do a bush pilot blog because we knew that there was a hole in the general aviation reporting field in Alaska, certainly for online, and that conveniently made us an aviation dependent business for the those who care about who occupies space in a hangar at Merrill mm-hmm. Field. The piece of that that we have yet to develop and have every intention of developing is a photograph your airplane photography business, because we know that all of us airplane owners and pilots, you know, feel like we do about grandbabies. Uh-huh. We want pictures.
Now, you have a long history in journalism. You're the CFO of U.S. News and World Report for a long time, and you also are a person of great means, and your husband, I guess, is one of the founders of the Carlyle Group.
Yeah, he has the great means. I have.
All right.
I have very nice means.
Enough means to do what you want to do, though.
Yes, that's the great freedom.
And at some point, what you wanted to do was do something with the media environment in Alaska. And I'm wondering what made you decide that that was what you were going to get into and put all this effort into and money.
Well, the short answer is I was very lucky to be one of the few people to come to Alaska from outside who got to know Alaska from the bush inward rather than from Anchorage or Juneau or Fairbanks outward. And that happened purely by happenstance, but also because the pilot couple who introduced me to the state were very grounded in the bush. Mm-hmm. Terry Smith was Aleut himself, and his first flying job had been the mail route for Bering Air. So I really, in a way, think of myself as from the bush as an Alaskan, which is kind of an odd thought given that I live in Anchorage and fly out of Merrill Field. But I know that there's an Alaska outside of Anchorage that is like a different country, and it's the one that resonates with me. Anchorage mm-hmm. to me is a convenience. But the real estate is out there. It's on the rivers. It's on the tundra. It's berry picking and fishing and the Bering Sea coastal storms and so forth.
Tell me about where you came from personally that caused that world to resonate with you, because it's pretty unique in this modern world. I mean, the rural Alaska is a thing in all by itself. But where were you from originally?
I'm entirely from the east coast of the U.S. All of my parents and generations before them, as an Alaska native would say, I am descended from. Uh-huh. All of those people are of Russian Jewish ancestry, uh-huh. although I myself have joined a Unitarian church, but I'm proudly of Russian Jewish ancestry, which includes some Polish and Lithuanian. And mm-hmm. And I think that maybe that is part of what predisposed me to find the native peoples, particularly of Western and Interior Alaska, who are still so predominantly ancestrally related to Russia, if anything, besides mm-hmm. Alaska Native. I think there's some connection there. I've never quite mm-hmm. been able to put my finger on it, but I know that a lot of people in villages will tell me that I have a kind face, and I've always thought that must mean there's something vaguely familiar about my face. Mm. And I certainly feel that way about their faces.
There was some strand in your being that made you fall in love with this place,
yeah,
with these people,
I think,
when you got here.
And in fact, there is a lot of common Russian ancestry.
Yeah.
So that may be the strand.
Now, one of your first projects that people were aware of was when you did Alaska House, when you took Alaskan native traditional art mainly,
right,
and put it in a high art setting in downtown Manhattan.
Right.
And and had some real critical success,
yeah.
but I guess not financial success. What inspired you to do that, and what was the project exactly?
Well, that was an outgrowth of two things that I had already been doing here for some years. The first was the Alaska Native Arts Foundation, which has mm-hmm. a gallery downtown here mm-hmm. at 6th and E, and has a website presence. And we had been trying very hard, not very successfully, to develop the online sales of Alaska Native art to people in the lower 48 and around the world, to the extent that the export restrictions on marine mammal products right. didn't get in the way. Mm-hmm. And we always knew that one of the things that would make a great big leap forward would be physically putting the art in front of art lovers and collectors outside of Alaska. So we had done that with some short-term steps in Washington, D.C., and with the Smithsonian, and it just seemed that New York was the place to go next. And with that exquisite sense of timing that I had, we opened for business in New York on the very day that Lehman Brothers went under, and, uh-huh. you know, it was kind of blood running in the streets of New York City right. in a financial sense. And so it was just a disastrously bad accident of timing. That meant that not only were art buyers not buying art, but the very people who we thought would help support our mission there weren't even in their jobs anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you make the best out of right. what your circumstances, and it turns out that it was very helpful for us. We did sell an awful lot of art. We found a lot of new collectors that way. But for me personally, the odd accidental connection was to the issues in the development of the Arctic, because there happened to be a brilliant Coast Guard fellow in residence at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, who was the only person to write anywhere in the world about the big picture in the receding, melting sea ice of the Arctic and what that would mean for the world's shipping routes, which, as we all know, thinking back to the Ottoman Empire, it's the shipping routes that determine the course of civilization in a geographic sense. And so we opened Alaska House New York with a symposium together with those folks, and we closed with a symposium with those folks, and that leads directly to what I've been doing here with the Arctic Imperative Summit as a conference, but also what we now have on the Dispatch website called Arctic Newswire, which is our Arctic section. Mm-hmm. We are trying to develop it further as fast as we can, but we hope to be able to aggregate the relevant news put out by any news organization anywhere in the world that has to do with the development of the Arctic. So it might be a Chinese newspaper.
Way beyond Alaska then. Yeah.
Well, but relevant to Arctic. And mm-hmm. I think of Alaska, all of Alaska, as Arctic. It isn't technically, of course, mm-hmm. but there is a definition somewhere in the law that says the Bering Sea is considered right. Arctic.
Well, the biggest thing that's happening in the Arctic this summer is the prospect of it turning into an oil field.
Correct.
As Shell does its exploratory drilling.
Right.
How do you personally feel about that?
Oh, I'm a practical person first and foremost. I'm really not an ideologue. I have mm-hmm. some very, very strong instincts and principles, but they have more to do with fairness and honesty and compassion mm-hmm. and so forth than with any one approach to legislation or policy. Mm-hmm. So I see many shades of gray everywhere. Mm-hmm. And as long as the world needs oil, the oil might as well come from oil companies in the U.S. as well as oil companies in Russia. We'll probably do a better job of protecting the environment than mm-hmm. others might, at least given today's legislative structure. So I don't pass judgment on that. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, neither does Alaska Dispatch, which is an interesting point.
But you're asking tough questions about it, and so that, I guess, makes some people think you're opposed. Is that...
Well, my feeling is that that's what makes for an intelligent democracy, is when mm-hmm. people ask tough questions about everything. And that's mm-hmm. why I love the press and have been involved with journalism my entire adult professional life, mm-hmm. really. Because I was at the Washington Post long mm-hmm. ago before I was at U.S. News.
You've learned to not state strong opinions in interviews, because that's...
Well, but on this one, I honestly don't have a strong opinion. Mm-hmm. I'm not pro or con oil drilling. I'm not mm-hmm. pro or con the world being on oil. Mm-hmm. I think it would be very nice if we could all have wind power and be hippie flower children, but I know that's not practical.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I find very interesting about you and the work you've done is that, you know, we talk about the native world and the sort of dominant culture, and that native people have to walk in two worlds. They have to learn to function in two different cultures. And I see you and I think, wow, you're kind of walking in three now, because the East Coast sort of money of and you know that whole world of, like, you're talking about Manhattan and then Anchorage and then the native
world.
It's
very true. I hadn't thought about it that way. And I do it via the same airlines that make everybody else's life miserable. So I have nothing but sympathy for those who commute on airplanes, especially run by our favorite airlines who shall go unmentioned.
But I mean, is that a personality aspect of you, just a curiosity in seeing how different people live? Or
You know, I guess it must be. I never set out on this journey knowing that this is where it would take me, so I mm-hmm. can't really answer that question. But I know that I hope to go even further. By next summer, I'm trying to find a small group of people who would like to do a general aviation expedition around the circumpolar Arctic, because I want to go meet everybody who lives within the Arctic Circle on the Arctic Ocean and see what their lives are like. There was a woman, I think her name was Sarah Wheeler, who wrote a book about one such journey she just did, describing her human interactions mm-hmm. in many places. And it was just fascinating to me how alike and yet how totally different they are in, say, northeastern Russia versus western Canada. So mm-hmm. I hope to go experience that for myself.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me that you're kind of an adventurer, somebody who wants to try new things and meet new people and go different places. And
I like to see big pictures come mm-hmm. together in my mind. I think mm-hmm. that's really what it is. It isn't the physical adventure. I'm kind of a wimp physically. I don't bungee jump.
So it's not the adventure of fear or risk. It's the adventure of experiencing new places and meeting new people. And it's not the stereotype of the wealthy that we have, which is that you go off and sit in Saint-Tropez or wherever
and sip
cocktails.
I'd get an allergic reaction very fast. I like to, I would say some of my most sacred, wonderful times are when I go moose hunting with a group of native friends up the Koyukuk, and I get to sleep under the stars by mm-hmm. the river at night for a week while watching and calling for moose. Those are mm-hmm. really magic times for me.
And your home now is here in Anchorage.
I commute from here to the East Coast instead of from the East Coast to here.
But your husband is traveling. I saw somewhere that he travels 300 days a year in his
By
work.
His own proud admission, yes. Mm-hmm. And that's why I decided I got to choose where I put my home, because there was just going to be me and my dog in it after my children
But you see
grew
each
up.
Other occasionally.
We do, actually.
In what city?
Actually, we're going to overlap next week at the Aspen Ideas Festival.
Oh, yeah. Which I heard was being highlighted on public radio today. So there you go.
Very Another smart connection. People talking. But I don't think on the subject of the Arctic this year, so we aim to help them fix that.
All right. This is One-on-One. I'm Charles Woolforth. My guest is Alice Rogoff, who is the owner of AlaskaDispatch.com, a large and growing news organization covering Alaska, a new news organization, and she's done so many other interesting kind of adventurous things about Alaska. But I wanted to talk more about the Dispatch, because we're living in such an unusual, strange time as our main newspaper, the Anchorage Daily News, you know, it was in competition for many years with the Anchorage Times. Anchorage Times goes out of business. The Daily News is hit by economic shocks and it's shrunk. And I gather that your new staff is equal to theirs or close to it.
We might even argue greater in their concentration on reporting Alaska news. I don't know, you know, we've got quite frankly, an amazingly talented bunch in the next room. And what unites them all is their passion for finding the stories that must be told, haven't been told, should be told and retold, and, you know, broadcast around the world. And we now try to do it in multimedia format with the addition of our new photographer, videographer. And, you know, I like to think that others out there will join with us, and there will be this growing chorus of voices that will start to talk about public policy and issues the way, quite frankly, people do and did when I lived in Washington, D.C. You know, I came of age during the Watergate years, and maybe that was what did this to me, but I can remember when we used to run downstairs in the morning when the thud of the newspaper landed on the front step, because you knew that Woodward and Bernstein were going to tell you something else that was just going to rock your boat that morning. That's something that sticks with you. And, you know, it may be that investigative reporting will go in and out of style, and who knows what that phrase means anyhow, because reporting should always be investigative. But If you're not, as citizens who vote, preparing yourself to understand the issues that are really behind the votes you're going to cast, then it's not a good democracy. So I don't like to sound like I'm a civics teacher, but it seems to me it's just what you have to do if you want to be a responsible citizen.
So are you, is this something you're doing for the public good, or is this a business where you're trying to
it's both
to, and to make some money?
You know, that's a really big frustration on our part. Tony and Amanda are part owners.
Tony
with
Hopfinger
me.
And Amanda Coyne, who were the founders, and then you came in
exactly
and grew it quite a bit.
Grew it, and I own more of it than they do, but we all feel like owners very much together. And it is very frustrating to see that in a state like Alaska, which by geography, at least, should be so much adapted to anything online, really from an advertiser standpoint, has been just the opposite. And I think it's because of this kind of time lag that happens here versus the lower 48 with everything. Technology gets here later and slower, and it is slower, and, you know, it's hard to load video if you're out on St. Lawrence Island because the signal isn't strong. But having said all that, the advertiser community is slowly coming around. We've seen our ad revenues grow up at a very nice rate of growth, but given the amount of penetration we have into the minds and, you know, eyeballs, so to speak, of the group of people who make the decisions in this state, we ought to have many more advertisers more of the time than we do so far. And I'm just waiting for that day to come, because it seems to me it's a business model that has been proven time and time again, and it will happen here.
Is anybody doing this same concept of a standalone edited, reported website on a like a geographic region like Alaska that's in the black at this point?
Not that we know of. But on the other hand, there are many of them out there who have given up on the notion of being in the black from advertising and gone to the not-for-profit model. We are not going to do that, because we believe that this is that corporations, as Citizens United would imply, are people. Well, okay, people. We're all in this state together. We're all voting for a legislature together. The legislature is setting policies that affect how we live every day. The ad revenue will come. And I think that it's just a matter of being a little bit more patient. We get nothing but positive feedback from everybody, even those who think that they don't especially like a story that somebody writes one day or another, and they're all welcome to those opinions, and we post the comments. But by and large, we've gotten very good feedback consistently.
And how many are on staff now?
It's a good question. It's somewhere around 20.
20 people. Is that something that you can sustain indefinitely in terms of the cost?
As long as the ad revenues keep growing, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Can and will, and will to my dying day, and then what my children have promised me, they'll do it in my name, and I know Tony and Amanda feel that way. We just, we just believe that this has to happen for the state to mm-hmm. grow in an intelligent way. And you know, so much is changing in the state. I look at my young friends who are in their 20s, who grew up in places like Nome and Bethel and went and got fabulous educations wherever they got them. And I was just hearing about one last night who was sitting at her village corporation meeting when votes were being cast for the board of directors of the village corporation, and she was sending tweets out to all her friends to get out and vote. You know, that's the new generation. So the world that ANCSA envisioned in 1971 is becoming a slightly different world, like everything, by technology, and it's exciting to see how it changes. And we who are living online are all going to be sort of swimming around in that pool together, learning how to keep on migrating with what the technology can do. But it is changing, and that's good.
Do you, I bet you get some really interesting feedback from Village Alaska from the stuff you publish. I know that when I've been on Talk of Alaska talking about subsistence, it's really interesting to come home and see I've got a bunch of emails from people talking about their subsistence out in rural Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
So they're wired, they're listening.
Absolutely.
Do you have a lot of readers across the state, do you think?
We do. Obviously, I wish we had more, but we have the sense now that in every community there's at least somebody reading us who's telling others about us. We don't get blank stares anymore from mm-hmm. people when we say who we are. And again, that's a big part of the commitment that Tony and I and Amanda made to one another when we got married, so to speak. Mm-hmm. We believe equally that the stories of civil disobedience by Yukon Delta subsistence fishermen is every bit as important as the story about what's going on in the education budget in Juneau. That we can't just assume that urban-centric news coverage defines what people should be thinking about in this mm-hmm. state, and on the contrary.
Well, for the Anchorage media, I think they cover Anchorage because it's a lot cheaper than putting somebody on an airplane and sending them to rural Alaska.
Absolutely.
You fortunately have your own airplane. Do you ever fly reporters out to the rural Alaska to do stories?
I do whenever I have a good enough excuse to. And believe me, mm-hmm. for me, it doesn't take much of an excuse. The most consistent pattern is for Iditarod, because we know we need my kind of an airplane to do that kind of coverage. We land on the rivers. So sometimes we'll land in the snow and set up a video camera and wait a few more minutes than our fingers might want us to wait for a musher to come by, and we'll shout greetings and whatever. But being able to get out there on wheel skis in winter and amphib floats in the summer is an incredibly effective way to see a slice of life you don't see. We were up doing a story on the bad runs on the king salmon in the Yukon 2 years ago, and we heard that the net sizes were going to be reduced, and that was before it had taken effect. So when you get out there, you learn so much that isn't known anywhere else around the state, that if you can do even a half good job of conveying it, mm-hmm. you really do improve the outcomes. Now, that's not going to make the fish come back. We understand that's a problem, but maybe there'll be some better sense of how to rejigger the equation about who gets the fish if more people understand the problem.
Well, at least somebody's there to tell the story, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's sort of this drive you have when you're in
absolutely
this business.
Tell all the stories. Let everybody understand the perspectives of the guys. They spend a lot of time being angry about thinking of us versus them when we're all just human beings trying to eat. And if you think about it that way, it's not so much us versus them. It's how do they get fish when they don't have food in their stores that they can buy instead of fish.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it's a lot about just connecting with people for you.
Well, for me, and for believing that everybody else would react the same way if they only had the connection. I remember some very well-intentioned person saying to me in a meeting somewhere one day, well, I'd love to go visit some villages, but I'm afraid that if I just showed up in an airplane, they would not want me to be there and I wouldn't feel welcomed. And I said, well, I've had only the opposite experience, and I can't count villages, but I've been to a good number, and I've never yet not been met by somebody with a smile and an offer of a ride into town. And is there anything you'd like to do while you're here? And where can I take you? So it's that missing link in the human connection that would make a huge difference in life here. I'm trying to encourage the development of what we call cultural tourism with Susan Bell and DCCED, because I think that that's what will live on when the cruise ships are long gone, is the notion that it would be really nice if you lived in Philadelphia or Corpus Christi to go see how people live in Naknek or Anaktuvuk Pass or wherever it might be. I particularly love St. Lawrence Island because it's the furthest away I've ever been with the greatest collection of brilliant people and
artists. You're doing it with your website, with our artistic efforts. I'm just really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So I'm Charles Wolforth. This is One-on-One. I've been talking with Alice Rogoff, co-owner of AlaskaDispatch.com. Thanks for being with us. Join us again next week for another episode of One-on-One.
One-on-One is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated. John LaFournaise directs and edits the show. Pat Yak is the producer. Camera operators are Travis Gilmore and Josh Edge. This is KSKA Anchorage FM 91.1.